here end now. In a few moments, our conversation about nuclear energy. Some longtime opponents are now saying, well, it's better than global warming. But first, the man who might be the next chief of the chiefs of staff, Navy Admiral Michael Mullen, the president's nominee to become the nation's top military officer, is facing the Senate Armed Forces Committee today. Mullen is expected to be confirmed by the Senate later this week. Also at his hearing, the nominee for vice chair, General Haas Cartwright. The administration decided to nominate Admiral Mullen after it became clear that the current chief, General Peter Pace, would face a tough fight on Capitol Hill if he were nominated for another term. Well, Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, has been following the hearings. And Dmitry, first of all, tell us, what's been the tone?
I think the tone has been very measured, Robin. Most of the members of the committee, if not all of them, seem to have a lot of respect for Admiral Mullen. They know he's going to be taking on a very difficult job, and I saw no sign that any of them are going to vote against him.
Well, it's interesting because in his written statements that he presented, he said that he'd been involved in rigorous debate with President Bush about the current surge in Iraq. Do we know, was he asked where he came down on the benefit of the surge in that debate? And, you know, if he was in favor of it, with so many senators now, you know, calling the surge a failure, you know, was he perhaps asked if he was one of the people responsible?
He said that he was in favor of the surge. He said he participated in the debate and he came down on the side of those who said it was worth trying the surge to see whether it would have an effect, give the Iraqi government political space to achieve reconciliation. I think the senators gave him some space because he was one of many people involved in the debate. Even when they have opinions about whether the surge is working or not, I think most of them are willing to wait until September before they make their final judgment. And Admiral Mullen's message to the senators today was, it's too early to make a judgment now. The fifth of the five additional brigades that made up the surge only arrived in Baghdad a little over a month ago. And he says they're making some progress and they need to wait until September and see what the final decision will be.
Well, it was also said that in his written responses he was candid. He admitted that there had been significant mistakes.
He did. He went through a litany of mistakes, and the main ones he said were there hadn't been enough dialogue with Iraqi neighbors, by which he presumably meant Iran and Syria. He said disbanding the Iraqi army was a mistake. The de-Ba'athification policy, which prevented many of the former members of Saddam Hussein's government, even the more junior middle-level members, from participating in government. And he also said there hadn't been enough troops for stability operations, in other words, after the major combat operations. Now, some of those have been said before. General Abizaid, who left CENTCOM about 6 months ago, admitted there hadn't been enough troops. But clearly there's a new team on the ground now. This is not the Rumsfeld era anymore, and these senior military officers feel free to say what they think was done well and was done badly.
What were some of the other direct questions that he took?
He was asked basically how long the U.S. could sustain the surge, and he was forced to admit from one of the senators, Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island, that essentially the surge has to come to an end by April because the U.S. does not have enough forces to maintain the 160,000 level that it has in Iraq at the moment, unless it changes the amount of time troops spend back home in the U.S. before they go back out to Iraq. And Robert Gates has said he doesn't want to make that time back home shorter. So essentially, April becomes a kind of a natural point on the timeline. He was asked about that. He was asked about Iranian involvement in Iraq, and he said he remained extremely concerned about their increased activity in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And he was asked about China. He said, interestingly, he thought that China, the U.S. needed to pay close attention to China, but they shouldn't overreact, but they also shouldn't underreact.
Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. It would seem that given the tone, the somewhat amicable tone today, that Admiral Mullen is on the fast track to being chair of the Joint Chiefs.
I would be very surprised if he's not approved out of the committee by the end of the week and then the Senate very shortly after that. There was no sign of any opposition from anybody.
And we, as we said, the Bush White House didn't resubmit the current chief because they were concerned that the hearings would be spent mostly in looking back as opposed to looking ahead. Did they seem to end run that today with this nomination?
I think they did. I think the problem with General Pace was he was seen as being someone who didn't stand up to Donald Rumsfeld, and he was tarnished by that, and the committee would have used his nomination as an excuse to look towards the past. And I think Robert Gates quite wisely decided that it was important for the Pentagon to look towards the future, and a way to do that was to pick someone like Admiral Mullen and not bring General Pace up for renomination.
Dmitry, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Now to nuclear energy. The last nuclear power plant built in the U.S. was in 1973. The worst commercial nuclear accident, the partial meltdown of the reactor core at the Three Mile Island Reactor Generating Station in Pennsylvania, was in 1979. No one was hurt, little radiation escaped the plant, but that scare and fears of a catastrophe put a nail in the coffin of future construction, and those concerns remain. But today, the New York Times reports that a single sentence buried in the energy bill just passed by the Senate could fuel an industry renaissance that's already underway, with plans to build 28 reactors in the coming years. The bill would make builders of those nuclear plants eligible for tens of billions of dollars in government loan guarantees, because nuclear energy qualifies as a clean energy. Yes, it produces radioactive waste, and the question of where to put that waste is a controversial one, but nuclear power plants are now considered clean because they don't produce the greenhouse gases that produce global warming. And that's exactly why nuclear energy is getting a second look, particularly from some previous hardcore opponents. Take Stuart Brand. He's the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. He's now telling his former enemies in the nuclear industry, "I'm sorry, you were right, I was wrong." What? David Whitford is editor-at-large for Fortune Magazine. He made a two-week road trip across America for his cover story, Going Nuclear. He joins us. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Robin.
Stuart Brand is one of the many people you met on sort of a road trip. Let's just start with him. "I'm sorry, I was wrong, you were right." What does he mean?
Well, Stuart Brand has come to believe that the most pressing problem facing us is global warming. And I think he's a realist in terms of how much electricity that we're going to need in the future. And Stuart Brand looks at that and he says, how are we going to get there? Wind is good, solar is good, but they're both insignificant in terms of how much of a dent they can make in that. So it really comes down to coal or nuclear. And when he compares the waste from coal, carbon dioxide, billions of tons into the atmosphere with unimaginable consequences, and nuclear energy with a very poisonous byproduct.
Spent fuel,
but one which he's come to believe is a solvable problem. I mean, what it comes down to with Stuart Brand is that it may already be too late for us to confront global warming in an effective way, but we have to do what we can. And given that reality, he sees nuclear power as the lesser of two evils.
Right. We've seen this before in this program in other ways. This is a contentious issue in a lot of pockets of the left. We had Amy Dominey, the socially responsible investor, on, and she is investing, or at least at the time we spoke with her, investing in nuclear plants for the same reasoning, very controversial. And on the other side of the coin, and as counterpoint, is Harvey Wasserman, someone else you also met. Who's he, and what's his stand?
Harvey Wasserman is one of the founders of the Clamshell Alliance. He's been fighting nuclear power since 1973 when he was living on what he calls a hippie farm in western Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. And he coined the phrase, no nukes.
That's what he says. He says it ran through my typewriter is what he says. Yeah. And Harvey's unreformed. You know, he is still strongly opposed to nuclear power. He sees far more potential in wind, solar, and other renewables than I think Stuart Brand does.
Well, and he also tells you that the anti-nuclear network from back in the day is intact. What did he say to you? It's a geezer battalion.
That's right. Yeah, he's 61, I think he said he is. And yeah, he says, we'll be back. He says, those of us who can still walk. He was especially adamant to get this message across to Fortune readers. It's not going to be easy for you people to force this on us this time. We're still out there. We're ready to mobilize. We're ready to go.
And we're going to bring our kids.
That's right.
Well, so there's the two sides of the coin. You quote the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying he's expecting applications for 27 new reactors over the next 2 years. We reported on Texas power utility TXU. They're not going to build their coal-fired generating plants they plan. Instead, they're going to build five jumbo nuclear plants. So, I mean, did you also feel that there's this renaissance?
Yeah, there's definitely something going on. We first began thinking about this story at Fortune when we had a visit from some people from the Nuclear Energy Institute. They come to New York once a year to talk to Wall Street. And the little revealing anecdote was that 2 years ago, they had about 40 analysts show up for their meeting. Last year, they had 80. This year, they had over 100. There's definitely growing interest on Wall Street. And there's a few things going on. I mean, the economics of nuclear power have always been daunting to people in the industry. But that may be changing. We're facing the prospect of a carbon tax. if suddenly all fossil fuels are subject to attacks based on greenhouse gas emissions, then suddenly coal becomes more expensive and nuclear power looks more attractive. There's also a whole package of incentives in place now that were part of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And those provide billions of dollars in incentives to first movers in nuclear power. So what the industry is hoping for is that they can, the first, you know, half dozen or so new plants can take advantage of those incentives, get new plants up and running, and persuade us that this is a good thing and that we don't need to be afraid of nuclear power.
And by the way, when you talk about expenses, because this is one of the big concerns, what are they? Is it the, you know, building the plants? Why is it so expensive?
Well, there's massive costs of construction. I mean, these things are incredibly complicated, and they take a long time to build. Much of that construction of key components has to take place overseas now, because in the past 30 years, during which the industry has been dormant, we've lost much of our capacity to build large components for nuclear power plants in the United States. But also because they take so long, they're subject to delay. There's always going to be people who are objecting to the plant, new plant being built. And so you run into long, unanticipated delays based on just getting the regulatory approval to proceed. And all this while, they're not producing electricity and they're not generating cash. Nuclear power plants are hugely profitable once they're up and running. It's that massive capital investment up front that makes them economically difficult.
Well, and let's talk about one of those issues. Where will they be built? One of the original, not in my backyard industries, especially after Three Mile Island, where will they be built? What are some of the questions there?
Well, they're not going to be built in new locations because the industry has no interest in going into virgin territory and trying to persuade a community that isn't already living with nuclear power that it would be in their best interest to have a new nuclear power plant built in their backyard. But what the industry surveys show is that the people living closest to the plants, now I'm sure there's exceptions to this, but generally speaking, people living closest to the plants tend to have a more favorable feeling about nuclear power than those of us who have less direct exposure to it.
That's interesting because I just want to jump in with, I have a relative who lives right near one in Limerick. Mm-hmm. And she has a stash of pills in her car and in her house, that is recommended in the event of an accident. I mean, they don't feel all that comfortable. Are you saying perhaps there's the comfort from, the jobs that are provided?
I think it's, in some cases there's a familiarity with it that grows over time and a comfort right. level that grows, but also, the jobs, the economic impact. But the plants, to get back to your original question, they're going to be built most likely at locations where plants already exist. Mm-hmm. One of them I visited was in Georgia, the Vogtle Electrical Generating Station in Georgia. They've got two big power plants there, and they've got pre-approval to build two more. It's places like that that are going to have the new plants.
Oh, by the way, the plant I mentioned is in Pennsylvania, and the iodine pills were actually distributed by the township, and that's part of the fear people have. You write about David Lockbaum, 17 years working in the nuclear industry, and he says the biggest problem is still an industry that's lax about safety. Well, when we come back, we'll go with you into a power plant control room. More after a break, here and now. Here and now. We're back with more from David Whitford, editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. He's just back from a two-week nuclear power reporting trip. He visited 14 facilities in 9 states, from Seabrook in New Hampshire to Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania and Yucca Mountain in Nevada, talking to industry officials, financiers, environmentalists about the possibility of a revival. Some are calling it a renaissance of the nuclear industry. This is just a little under 30 years after the scare at Three Mile Island and the film China Syndrome, equally scary, that was ironically running the same week as Three Mile Island. David, most people have never been inside a nuclear power plant. You gained access to 3 control rooms. What did they look like?
The amazing thing about the control rooms when you walk into them is that you feel like you're walking into the set of a 1960s science fiction TV show. And that's because these control rooms were all designed and in many cases built in the 1960s or the 1970s. So what you see is not a lot of digital stuff. You see analog devices. You see clocks with dials on them. You see switches. You see buttons that have keys in them. You feel like you're going back in time.
You share the anecdote that whereas outside the control room you're wearing earplugs and hard hats, but then what happens once you get in the control room?
Well, there's certain rules that you follow, right? Nothing dangling from your person.
Because?
Because you don't want it to get in the way. when you're standing around this console of all these buttons and switches.
Flip a switch with your iPod.
Right. So they make you take your hat off, for example, your hard hat, because at some point, somewhere along the line, you know, somebody leaned over and the hat fell off, and you don't want to trip a switch that's better left untripped.
Gosh. Well, and inside the control room, in the event of something like that, there are red switches with the acronym SCRAM.
That's right. SCRAM is an acronym that was coined by one of the pioneers of nuclear power, Enrico Fermi, who presided over the world's first successful chain reaction at the University of Chicago. The story is, this was in 1942, that he stationed a colleague next to these ropes that were used to lower and raise the control rods. The control rods, once they're lowered into the reactor, will stop the reaction. And he wasn't sure, this being the first time, whether they might not need to lower those control rods in a hurry. And so he stationed a colleague next to the rope and gave him an axe, and he said, if I give you the signal, chop the rope, the control rods will drop down, that'll stop the reaction.
And the guy's title was Safety Control Rod Axeman,
right.
Which is SCRAM. Instead of that axe, there are switches that do the same thing.
That's right. If you watch the China Syndrome, you'll hear them refer to the SCRAM switch on that movie.
It's an industry that hasn't done much. It's been dormant for 30 years. If it's even to start building, are there people who can do it?
Well, that's an interesting point. People basically stopped training to become nuclear engineers 30 years ago. Three Mile Island was a watershed event. It led to shutting down of academic departments at universities all over the country. Nuclear engineers have continued to be trained elsewhere around the world, but not so much in the United States. That stuff's just gearing up again. But if anything close to these 30 or so plants end up getting started in the next decade or so, we're going to need a lot more skilled workers and a lot more trained engineers than we have now.
Another concern with nuclear power is waste, and not just from the plants, new plants that might be built, but there's about 55,000 tons already in existence. You visited Yucca Mountain, the place where the plan is to store the nation's nuclear waste. It's supposed to start receiving it in 2017. Is that, do you think that's ever going to happen?
2017 is the absolute earliest possible point where Yucca Mountain could begin to receive waste from nuclear power plants. Not even the engineers and the administrators who are working there believe that it will happen by 2017. So what we have now, instead of one Yucca Mountain where receiving all the waste, is that the 104 nuclear power plants that are operating in America all store their own waste on site.
Well, this was the debate that Stuart Brand, again, the anti-nuke guy, who now is, as he said, a moderate supporter of nuclear energy. He was part of the debate. His side was insisting that waste not be disturbed for at least 10,000 years. And he's even said, well, maybe we have to rethink that. Because the Canadians, what, they pledged to put theirs away for 175 years.
Right. They had a different notion that that Stuart Brand, I think, favors, and it was a fascinating discussion. I mean, his point is, look, let's go 175 years out now, and we're going to be either in one of two situations. Either we're going to be a lot smarter about what to do with the waste and a better plan for it than we can conceive of now, or the worst will have happened because of global warming or nuclear war or whatever, and we'll be living in the Stone Age, and a little bit of radioactive waste in Nevada is going to be the least of our problems. You know, what he's questioning is this whole concept. I mean, we're saying that we're creating this awful waste now, and we owe it to future generations to solve the problem now. We can't foist it on the future. But maybe, since we don't have a great idea now, maybe it does make more sense to foist it on the near future rather than the far distant future.
Meaning 175
years. 175 years as opposed to 10,000 years, yeah.
Well, so what do you think is going to happen? We've just had an incident in Japan, the world's largest nuclear power complex. An earthquake tips over barrels of contaminated material, spills hundreds of gallons of low-level radioactive water into the sea. And then on the other hand, we have what you found was a renaissance of, you know, an industry saying it's going to gear up again because concerns about nuclear waste are trumped by concerns about global warming. So what do you think, what do you see happening?
Well, so this is a live debate. The terms of it are changing every day. The episode in Japan happened as we were closing the story, and we wondered for a while whether this was going to be the kind of cataclysmic event that would make everything else that we talked about in our story irrelevant. If there were another event like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, far worse event, anything like that, or a terrorist attack on a nuclear power plant, we would lose our appetites overnight for further development of nuclear power. The industry knows that they're dealing with a very delicate balance here.
David Whitford, editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. His cover story, Going Nuclear, appears in the current edition. And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this related note, yesterday, a man crashed his car into a cement barrier after driving through a security checkpoint at a nuclear weapons plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. That plant is a primary storehouse for bomb-grade uranium. Police say the man refused to show identification, drove through, and then ran away after crashing his car. Well, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, ever hear of the dog diet? You take cues from your pet on eating. How about the Beck diet? It promotes mind over cheesecake. We'll cut through the fat of this billion-dollar diet industry. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, The View, Arab style, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. As we heard in our top story, the new nominee for Joint Chiefs Chairman, Navy Admiral Michael Mullen, told Congress in hearings today that the military is stretched thin and the surge in Iraq can't continue past spring. Well, with that in mind, each branch of the military will spend hundreds of millions of dollars on recruiting this fiscal year. A few weeks ago, some of the Navy's recruiting budget was spent here at Boston University, where just over 200 people from the area took what's called the Trident Challenge. Karen Given of NPR's Only a Game has the story.
Outside Boston University's Fitness and Recreation Center, helium balloons and rock music herald the Navy SEALs, who'd arrived earlier by parachute. Inside, Petty Officer Sean Tufts smiles as he gently prods a group of about 25 athletes who've come to test their skills against the Navy SEALs.
You guys fired up?
Yeah!
You guys fired up?
Yeah!
All right, go out there. Max effort, right? Max effort. I don't want to see anybody sandbagging.
Let's go. Get in the water.
All 200 people who'd answered radio and print ads to take the Trident Challenge will be asked to do the same PST, or physical screening test, that Navy recruits must pass in order to enter SEAL training. There's swimming, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and a mile-and-a-half run. It all sounds a little scary.
You shouldn't be afraid of working out, and that's all we're going to do.
Petty Officer John Murray is a SEAL who's been serving in Afghanistan and Iraq for most of the past 6 or 7 years, and he knows how to make the day sound easy.
It's the short little run, a swim, some push-ups and pull-ups, and that's all. Come on, it's fun. Have a little fun. Get off the couch, get your lazy butts off the couch, get down here, and work out a little bit, get in shape.
Two more, come on, two more, two more, two more, come on.
There are currently fewer than 2,500 SEALs, and the Pentagon wants to grow that force by more than 500 in the next 5 years. To that end, the Navy has started recruiting at marathons, triathlons, extreme sports events, and college swimming and wrestling camps. But Cornell Galloway, program advertising manager for Navy Recruiting Command in Tennessee, insists the Trident Challenge isn't part of that effort.
Well, actually, the Navy is really aware of the condition of physical fitness in our schools amongst our youth, and we wanted to kind of give back and make a contribution in that effort. So we wanted to challenge the community and to see how everybody stacked up against their physical condition against the Navy SEALs.
Galloway isn't saying how much the challenge is costing the Navy, but between renting out the facilities at BU, flying in the Leapfrogs, the Navy's skydiving team, and advertising costs, it can't be cheap.
No, but you can't put a value on you know, return of investment out there. Real benefit is how they feel about themselves at the end of the competition.
The military doesn't publish total marketing dollars spent recruiting at sporting events, but last year the Marines reportedly spent $6.5 million advertising on ESPN. The Navy sponsors the Winter and Summer X Games. The Army stages the U.S. Army All-American Bowl.
Considering that the armed services often have to struggle to meet recruiting goals, it's vital that every single tax dollar be spent effectively.
Pete Sepp is with the National Taxpayers Union.
Unless the armed services are comprehensively tracking the results for the money they've spent, it would make sense to hold off spending any more until they can figure out whether this money is being invested effectively.
At the Trident Challenge, nobody's handing out pamphlets extolling the virtues of military service, and the only recruiting comes from a video playing quietly on a TV that no one's watching. But John Allen Williams, professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago and retired captain in the Naval Reserve, says the day is an effective recruiting tool nonetheless.
Let's face it, a young man who is just, you know, in the throes of adolescence and still unsure about himself and his body is changing, and to have some Navy SEAL tell him, hey, you could be one of us, this is powerful stuff. And this is exactly the kind of person that they want to recruit.
16-year-old John O'Shea is a good example. He finishes the mile-and-a-half run in 8:04, and he barely looks like he's broken a sweat. O'Shea says he didn't come here to find out about joining the military. He just wanted to have fun and get a good workout. But after a day of teamwork and booyahs, he's considering it.
They haven't put pressure on anyone, but it kind of makes you want to go in and, because it looks like fun and pushing yourself to the limit, and that's what I like to do, so it sounds pretty cool.
Even though they go off to war?
That's the only part I don't like. I don't like the shooting people and getting shot at. That's the only reason why I wouldn't do it, but it sounds cool.
O'Shea will leave with a free T-shirt and a copy of a DVD called Defending Freedom in the 21st Century. For its end of the deal, the Navy requires quite a bit of information from him. Not only his name, age, and contact information, but also how he scored on 5 different physical tests, entered into a trackside computer by civilians in white T-shirts. Joe Galzetti with Campbell Ewald, an ad agency hired by Navy Recruiting, says the scores are recorded so participants can look on the internet to find out how they ranked, not for the benefit of recruiters. But as our interview concludes, Galzetti decides to rethink his answer.
Well, no, it's about the recruitment thing, and there is information that's happening, and there is a chance that, yes, somebody will get a phone call. If people want to provide us their information, which they do, they're going to get a phone call from the local recruiter.
Most of those who've come out for the challenge are athletes in their late teens and early 20s, and almost exclusively male. While many showed up in dark-colored, skin-tight swimming trunks, 52-year-old Debbie Duffy arrived in a pink-flowered bathing suit, beneath which you could see the scar from a heart valve replacement 10 years ago. Duffy started out the day thinking positively, but after not being able to do a single pull-up, she's losing faith.
I hate him. I couldn't try any harder.
Was that worse than the swimming?
Much worse. Worse than push-ups. I like push-ups in comparison.
So what do you think so far? All you have left is the run? That's all you have
to
do?
I hate running. Last time I ran was into my husband's arms, and he's been dead a year and a half, so I hate running.
Superman is the man of steel.
Superman is the man of steel.
But he ain't no match for no Navy SEAL.
19-year-old Joe Bennett signed up to join the SEALs 2 months ago. He has spent most of the day offering encouragement to Duffy. He leads the group in a cadence to help her make it through the mile-and-a-half run. Duffy is thrilled.
Hey, Cameron, I want to be Lois.
I don't want to be no Green Beret. I don't
want to be no. As the group rounds the final corner, Duffy breaks into a sprint and crosses the finish line with her arms raised high. As she catches her breath, she's full of praise for Bennett and the guys who helped her make her way around the track.
Well, actually, these are the same ages that get on a plane and go to Iraq, so it shouldn't surprise us, but it does. I always looked up to Navy SEALs. I always have, and all the people in the military, I always have, even more so now, that they would do this for a 52-year-old broad, you know?
The Navy hasn't yet decided if they'll hold the Trident Challenge again next year. But if they do, Debbie Duffy says she'll be there. Joe Bennett ships out for basic training on November 26th.
Pick them up, put them down.
Our visit to the Trident Challenge was produced by Karen Given of NPR's Only a Game. Well, before we go today, the Arab version of the TV talk show The View, you're listening to Here and Now.
Good job, guys. Don't sweat.
4:34.
We have some news for you now. Rupert Murdoch has reportedly won his bid to buy the Wall Street Journal and its parent company, Dow Jones Company. According to the Wall Street Journal's website, the Bancroft family has accepted Murdoch's offer. The deal is expected to be signed tonight, ending a three-month-long dance between Murdoch, one of the world's most powerful media moguls, and the Bancrofts, a family that's owned the Dow since 1902. Well, joining us is Sasha Pfeiffer, business reporter for the Boston Globe. And Sasha, do we know what happened? Because last night, the late reports were that members of the Bancroft family were still holding out.
Right, and it looks like an interesting side deal might have helped ink this, which is that the Bancroft family had racked up about $30 million in various legal and advisory fees, and it looks like News Corp will pick up the tab for that, and that may have played a role in the family agreeing to this deal.
What's been some of the reaction? I mean, Reuters is, in an early report, is quoting an analyst saying that, so much for principles. What's been some of the reaction?
Well, the reaction is all over the board. I mean, there's a lot of distress among Wall Street Journal reporters who feel that their newspaper could be compromised by a new owner who might meddle editorially. There are other analysts who believe that the Wall Street Journal Murdoch will take a hands-off role and the Wall Street Journal will continue being the crown jewel of American journalism. There are also questions about whether this deal was just too handsome to turn down. It was an enormous premium, $60 a share. At the time, I think it was traded in the 30s, and whether they had a financial obligation not to turn it down.
Right. Well, let's remind ourselves, members of the Bancroft family, who again owned 64% of Dow Jones voting stock, were afraid that Rupert Murdoch would hurt the journalistic integrity of the Journal. And, we should say, to many readers, the Journal is two papers, one the reporting pages, the other the editorial page, which is considered much more to the right. We had an analyst on the program who said that actually Rupert Murdoch, although to the right of center, was to the left of the editorial page. So what is the thinking of, whether or not has he given assurances that he won't interfere either with the editorial page or with the reporting?
I think it's a total wild card. I mean, he has a history. People believe he has a history of meddling in other media pieces he owns. They have put in place what's called an editorial integrity agreement, which is intended to protect against meddling. It creates a committee that supposedly has the legally enforceable right to sue him, try to get an injunction if they believe he's meddling. So that's been put in place to try to ease those fears.
Mm. Well, what happened to this paper? Everybody knows, the Dow Jones, they watch the stock index. It's one of the most read newspapers in the country. I think it's number two behind USA Today. So what happened? Why was it in this position?
Well, the Bancroft family, which has owned it for more than a century, has had a history of being pretty uninvolved in the management. And so, the newspaper industry is struggling. There's a question about whether newspapers can be standalone entities, whether they need to now be part of sort of conglomerates that are part online, part broadcast. And I think that when this deal came up, the family was a bit blindsided, and it was just such a handsome premium that it was hard to say no.
Yeah, and it just didn't seem to be getting the kind of profits that some other shareholders who may not have had as much of an interest in the editorial side that they wanted.
Exactly, and that's the question. When you have public ownership, people demand constantly increasing returns, and the expectation is that public shareholders who have about 29% stake will probably mostly vote for this, which would create a healthy majority.
And we should explain, too, there may be still people who aren't sure what the concern was. I mean, Rupert Murdoch has papers in which, women appear bare-breasted.
Exactly.
What are some of the concerns about the way he's run other papers?
Well, there have also been concerns that, for example, he would give flattering or unflattering political coverage to politicians in hopes of getting some political payback in return. And, again, there's a fear that he could end up using the Wall Street Journal's resources and reputation for his own commercial or personal interests.
I just don't see a bare-breasted woman in those little pixelated pictures in the Wall Street Journal, but I'm just wondering, in the less than a minute we have, there's a bureau here in Boston where we are. Have you talked to any of the reporters? Are they worried about any of the aspects of a buyout, layoffs, anything?
I've talked to many of the reporters. They're all extremely concerned, all of them speaking not for attribution. I think they're not so concerned, interestingly, about layoffs. I mean, they actually think Murdoch may put money into the paper, as they are concerned that the new paper will no longer be taken seriously, that the paper's reputation will be compromised, and they're holding their breath.
Yeah. That's Sasha Pfeiffer, business reporter for the Boston Globe, on News Today. Not yet confirmed. There's supposed to be a confirmation tonight that Rupert Murdoch has bought the Dow Jones Company and the Wall Street Journal, and we'll continue to follow this story for you. Sasha, thanks so much.
Thank you, too.
Okay, when we come back, The View Arab Style. That's after a quick break here and now. and Young, It's Here and Now. It seems impossible, given the image many Americans have of Muslim women in Arab countries. But every Sunday night on Arabic satellite television, four Muslim women sit down, just like Rosie O'Donnell and Barbara Walters used to do on The View, and they talk about polygamy, wearing the veil, and even masturbation.
هو فعل يمارس منذ آلاف السنين ومع ذلك تغلفه ستر من التعتيم والكتمان وتصاحبه مشاعر الخوف والذنب.
The wildly popular television show Kalam Nawayam, or Sweet Talk, was adapted from ABC's The View. It has four hosts, a Palestinian, a Saudi, a Lebanese, and an Egyptian, all different ages, different backgrounds. It frequently stirs up controversy and consistently rates in the top 10. Dutch filmmaker Brechia van der Haak brought her camera behind the scenes of the popular show for a documentary called Dishing Democracy. It airs tonight on PBS's Wide Angle series, and she joins us now.
Hello.
We're also joined by Rania Barhout, one of the four hosts of Sweet Talk. Rania, welcome to you as well.
Hello.
And I want to start with you. It's so much fun watching this, but also, you know, there's a lot of tension in putting this program together. Tell us about some of the topics that you and your co-hosts talk about that have been more controversial.
You mentioned female masturbation, and we discovered that nobody talks about it. It's under the wraps, as you might say. And when we brought it to light, it was like an eye-opener to many women and girls.
It literally under wraps. You have women who are not only shrouded by their head coverings, speaking about, you know, their experiences with masturbation, they're also, you know, their faces are blacked out. And it's a sort of a forbidden topic. When you say you have a wide range, we're talking about a viewership in the entire Arab world and a panel that represents much of the Arab world. You're Lebanese, married to an Egyptian. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the other women on the show? Muna, for instance, who wears a head covering on the program, is a Saudi. Tell us about her.
She has studied in the U.S. She has an open mind about every subject, but she has reservations on how to discuss the topics we actually feature on the show.
In fact, the topic of terrorism was going to be discussed in one issue, and Brechia, you taped a lot of the pre-show discussions in the sort of the makeup room as the women were getting ready, and she was very, very upset about this topic. Let's listen.
No, do I want to make a statement? I'm thinking about making a statement.
But make a statement. What's the point of making a statement?
The problem is that with terrorism, they keep putting it on poverty. None of the 19 people who blew up the World Trade Center were poor. I just don't know if I want to sit through another segment that does this.
Rania, she goes on to say on the program that she also is very concerned that whenever the topic of terrorism is raised, she fears for how Saudis are portrayed.
We are all concerned about, if you mention the word Muslim, it means terrorist. She was very concerned about her image and about the way we were discussing it, probably the approach we were discussing it. But she is very opinionated, and she stands by her beliefs, and she is not, easily deterred.
Tell us about the others, one from Egypt and one a Palestinian.
Fawzia is our Barbara Walters, if you want. She is the voice of wisdom, the voice of calm. She's also very opinionated. She's a journalist. She's an Egyptian living in London, and so am I.
And then you have a host who's Palestinian.
Yes, she's Palestinian-Jordanian, living in Egypt, married to an Egyptian as well. Funnily enough, we're all married to Egyptians. Muna just got divorced from one.
And we all have daughters.
And we all have daughters, girls.
Brechia, tell us about who watches the program. You have scenes of men gathered around tables at outdoor cafes watching. Who's watching the show?
I think everybody's watching the show. I think all over the Arab world, from Morocco to Yemen, people are staying up to watch it.
Do you have a number of viewers?
Well, the genius about satellite TV is that it's completely transnational. It can reach the Arab-speaking community all over the world, you know, also here in Amsterdam or in London, and many Americans are watching in Florida, for example. Roughly speaking, a little under 300 million Arab speakers worldwide, and I would say that at least 200 million of them have heard of Kalam Nawayam.
Yeah, I have been on television for the past 20 years, and we are tackling topics that have never been tackled before.
men and women are writing in to tell us either to condemn or to condone, but we are being watched all over the world. It's not just the Arab world, all over the world.
Well, you get a lot of feedback. We see you reading a lot of the letters, and some of them are painful. There's a segment where a viewer who calls himself, I'm quoting now, a brother who doesn't love you, tells all of you, except Muna, the Saudi woman who wears a head covering, that you are barely dressed and you are going to go to hell. Let's listen to some of that.
We're terrible women. We are corrupting Arab societies. We are the devil.
I don't think it would be advisable to debate this on television.
You have to read such letters, unless you have to say إنه في ناس ما بيعجبهم.
يعني أنا شوف إيش وجهة نظر. لما واحد بيقول لك أنا مؤمن وأنا مسلم.
Rania, you say, who but God can judge a Muslim? You know, it's one thing for Rosie O'Donnell on The View here in the U.S. You know, she gets in hot water and got probably released when she got too controversial for maybe some viewers and advertisers.
Yes, but we followed that.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems as if the stakes are higher where you are with these topics. I mean, do you worry about...
No, we get hate letters. I'm sure everybody on television gets hate letters. And this person in particular, we were completely adamant not to give him a voice, because he was writing in as a complete fanatic. And I don't like at all to feature people who are fanatic about or extremists about their views or their religion, because religion is free for all. It's between you and your God, and whether you're practicing or not, that's your liberty. Mm. So if we're worried about of our safety, no, definitely not.
But Brachia, I'm wondering too. As I was watching, Rania mentioned she lived at one time in London. It seems as if at least some of the women don't live in the countries that they represent anymore. Do you think that the four women on the show are leading some changes in the Arab world, sort of slightly ahead of the curve and maybe leading it, or are they a symbol of change that's already taking place?
Well, I was very much interested in exploring that, exactly that question, because I think they are pushing change, but I think they're pushing it very gently, and that they're very sensitive to their audience, and that's why it works, I think. I think that to impose change, it's not working, especially not in the Arab world, I think.
That's Brekia van de Haak, director of Dishing Democracy, which airs tonight on most PBS stations. You can check our website, here-now.org, for your local listing. We've also been speaking with Rania Barhout. She's one of the hosts of Kalam Nawayam, or Sweet Talk. We've talked about some of the more serious issues, but what are some of the most fun ones you've
done? Well, we had so many fun topics. One of them was a man married to 13 women, and every time a woman gets old, he divorces her and marries another. He has about 130 kids. He doesn't know their names. And another man who had four women living in the same building with all their children. And the women, as soon as he comes home, they become his love slaves, basically, and they choose each day of the week to be with him. These were fun, and at the same time, they were an eye-opener to many women as to where the hell are they going. Sorry about that word, but...
Well, it sounds as if the hosts of Kalam Nawayam come calling to ask you to be in a segment. You may want to look out.
Yeah. Yes, I'll keep that in mind.
Rania, thank you very much as well.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.